Welcome, bienvenue, foilche, maraban, ongiatori, swagata, huan yin ni lai, bonvenon, kalosilthate, ibiala, yokoso, lokiamis, salamat datang, dobro dosil, karibunyi, yindi ton rap, barukaba, kush hamdid, and wagwan to Worst Foot Forward, the podcast that each week uncovers the best of the worst. I'm Ben van der Velde, and I'm absolutely knackered from saying hello to you. So now it's time to say au revoir, tot sien, bidaya, joygin, dovidenja, yasu, auf wiedersehen, vijlat, slan, arrivederci, zaijian, koda hafiz, dosvidanya, adios, lagon, hambakale, lehitraot, sayonara, alvida, moika, adijo, and Brexit means Brexit to you all. And with me is the slippery babelfish to my welcoming ear canal, Barry McStay.
Oh, usually I get associated with Sodom, not Babel.
Well, I believe they had many tongues there.
Yeah. I just want to pick you up in your pronunciation of slán, which is the Irish for goodbye.
Oh, man. What did I say? Slán?
Slán, yeah. Ben very pointedly, just before we started recording, said, can you teach me how to say the Irish for hello, which is foilche? I said, just think of foil chair. And I notice now you very confidently didn't ask me how to say slán.
Because it's written S-L-A-N.
There's a fodder, there's a dash over the A.
Oh, like I know where that exists on the word keyboard. I have now opened up the Worst Foot Forward globe and encouraged thousands more listeners from all sorts of different countries, or I've just committed a number of international incidents.
Yeah. We're the worst duo to give you any lingo, I think.
Yeah. Oh, very nice. I think we very probably are. Now, how much of a polyglot are you?
I've never eaten a parrot in my life.
Unbelievable.
I speak English. I was quite fluent in Irish when I finished secondary school, but I haven't really spoken it at length for about 15 years. And I learned French, and I was reasonably good French speaker again 15 years ago.
Okay, so past Barry is more multilingual than present Barry.
And I studied Latin up to the age of 19 as well.
Of course you did.
Yeah.
Of course you did.
QED. Sexy, sexy. Yeah.
Well, I recently watched The Two Popes, and of course, Pope Nazi loved speaking in Latin when he had things that were very difficult to say.
Yeah.
So earlier today, Barry did say something about podcast Mortus Sum. I don't really know what he's going on about, but I'm sure it's all fine.
It's funny there hasn't been a Pope Nazi the second, isn't it?
Yeah. I still love Eddie Izzard's joke of talking about the Pope during World War II as Pope Gutless Bastard the First.
Listen, let me introduce our guest. Our guest this week is a London-based actor, writer, lyricist, linguist, and teacher. He graduated from University College London in 2011 with a bachelor's degree in language and culture, a course that doesn't even exist anymore. He literally is the final word in language and culture. At UCL, he studied European culture from the classics to the modern day, or from Beowulf to Blade Runner, as his course described it. Though these days, of course, he feels his expertise could be better summarized as from dragons to drag race. He has a background in linguistics and studied the work of such literary geniuses as Virgil, Seamus Heaney, and Avril Lavigne. And on the subject of Avril, I really must say, Rich, I'm with you. Indeed, her work is very complicated, but I find you really can't get into it if you keep holding on. And so, you go, girlfriend. In conclusion, skater boy. A decade on from university, Rich is now an expert in defaming Disney, having penned his one-man parody show Happily Ever Pufter, in which he spreads magic, joy and naughtiness as a gay prince in search of a happy ending, ooh or misses, etc. He is also another of the merry gang of Maze Masters at London's Crystal Maze Live Experience, and when not on stage, he shares his love of education and literature with tomorrow's generation, moonlighting as a tutor and homeschool teacher for primary school children. A gay Gemini actor with a love of tongues, both foreign and domestic, it's like looking in a mirror. He truly is the fairest in the land. It's Rich Watkins.
Hello. Oh my goodness, what a camp introduction. And I was almost crying, Ben, at the beginning of that, because it was a beautiful demonstration of inclusivity and terrible, terrible tonguemanship. So well done. Nice try, but... What a start. I mean, can I just go home now? You've done it all. That was great.
That's very kind of you. I know it's not possible to leave reviews for people on Grindr, but if I was ever on there, that would be my review on Grindr.
Terrible tonguemanship.
Yeah, no, wonderful diversity, terrible tonguemanship.
Also, you think you can't leave reviews on Grindr? People do their damn best.
Yeah.
Pointing the finger at me, four fingers pointing at you. So enough about four fingers. Yeah.
How have you been in lockdown? How have you been coping? Are you venturing out into the wider world at the moment?
I have been out and about and doing things and seeing things, and I've been on some public transport, which has been a thrill.
Ooh.
But at the moment, I'm back in isolation because I'm going away, like a very sensible holiday. We're going to Wales. I'm going to the countryside in Wales. It's not really the grand voyage that I imagined this year.
It's very easy to socially distant there between the valleys.
Yeah.
Exactly. It's going to be me and some sheep and some friends of mine, and we're all isolating this week. So it's a little bit like I'm back in April. This is what it was like at the beginning when I stayed inside for 24 hours a day.
We cannot get virus nostalgia for like what it was like in the early days of lockdown.
But I feel like we're in like chapter 7 of lockdown. We have been through tomes upon tomes, and the beginning was definitely like the prologue, like what is this about? What's going to happen? And then chapters 1 through 3 were like, this is wild. And then chapters 4 through 6 got dark as fuck. And now we're like three quarters through the novel. Who knows? I mean, this could be a 7-part series. But like, I definitely feel like we are on a different episode from the beginning.
I think you're right. Also, virus nostalgia, you are making me now live in fear of in about 10 years' time that I remember 2020 TV clip show. And there's those people going, it was shit, I stayed in, I got Deliveroo, I put on 15 stone.
Like lots of comedian talking heads sitting around going, God, you remember Zoom? Wasn't that wild?
And the big names of 2020, the people that broke onto the scene, and I literally, other than Chris Whitty, do not know who they'll be.
For our American listeners, Chris Whitty is our Dr. Anthony Fauci.
Yeah, except I think less capable and certainly less charismatic. Yeah. He sort of looks like an embarrassed pencil. Do you want to ask, obviously we're about to ask you what you're terrible at, Rich, but I want to find out how many languages you can speak as well.
I speak French, I speak Italian, I speak German, I did study Latin, I speak camp. My degree was very kind of all across the board European languages, so I picked up a little bit of Swedish and touched on Hungarian, and we were actually part of the Scandinavian Studies department, even though I studied French and Italian. So I turned up on first day of university thrilled to throw myself into Western European culture and spaghetti and pan au chocolat and whatever, and all of my faculty were totally invested in Swedish and Danish and Dutch and Norwegian. And I was like, I don't understand how we're going to spend the next 4 years together. One particular exam question was I had to identify the morphemes of a particular word, and it was smorgasbord, and I felt very continental when I knew all the morphemes of smorgasbord.
Yeah.
even though it's a word that we have taken ourselves in the English language, so it didn't even really count as being able to speak.
Oh, I thought you said a smorgasbord of morphine, and I had a whole different idea of what it was like in university. Yeah,
that was my post-university.
Yeah.
And as well as being a cunning linguist, what are you worst at in the world?
In a pre-lockdown world, I would have said something really sassy and fun, but in a lockdown world, I think my answer is commitment. I've started so many projects in this lockdown, and I have all these grand ideas. I'm going to write the next thing and read the next book. The amount of unread books, or begun books and unfinished books, I should say, that I have are literally around me right now. And I've got two right there. I've got a project on the floor that I haven't finished, and I've got a dinner that I haven't even finished eating. So I begin projects and cannot see them through to the end. So I apologize if I log off this call halfway through. It's just in my nature. It's just who I am.
Hello and welcome to Castable. This is a brand new podcast where we get amazing guests to come and pitch their dream music festival. I'm Matt Hoss and I'm the host. I'll be there to interview, to analyze, and get to the depths of why they think their music festival is the best. We're going to be talking about music, camping, and why we love the music that we do. It's a podcast looking at the things we love and why we love them. Download Castable today on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or Podbean. Join the festival today.
This week's show is yet another Patreon special. Our regular donor, Johanna Koivunen, has demanded that we dive into the choppy linguistic waters of the world's worst language. She specifically asked for some Hildegard von Bingen action, and don't worry, Johanna, that will be coming up later in my section. But for now, Barry, you're going to kick us off with your A to Z of the worst languages.
Yes, I am. I'm going to start you off with a quote from Mark Twain. German, the German language, has three genders, which led Mark Twain to wonder why a young woman has no sex but a turnip has. But I thought I'd read a bit about the Rosetta Stone.
Oh, great.
Not just an app for teaching you languages, but it was a slab discovered by French soldiers when they were in Egypt in July 1799, which weighs about a ton and has three columns of script in hieroglyphics, in Egyptian Demotic, which was the common Egyptian tongue at the time, and in Greek. And modern people were able to speak Greek, so they were able to then go back and translate hieroglyphics using the Rosetta Stone. Funny enough, the French only had it a couple of years, and then the British commandeered many of the Egyptian artifacts that the French had collected during their occupation, including the Rosetta Stone. I know, right? The French general even tried to keep the stone specifically for himself, and the British were like, oh no, that looks interesting.
See, what I love about the Rosetta Stone, it's one of those things that if the world were a computer game, then it very much is a power-up for the modern world. And also, the way the British nicked it, it's clearly like they Wario'd into the French general, and it burst out of him. They're like, oh, we're getting that, please.
That sums up the British attitude towards everything, and that kind of sums up the English attitude towards language. Like, we're here now, we exist, forget yours.
Yes.
Which I'm sure we'll get onto later today.
Yeah. It's in the British Museum and has been since 1802. The French did get to host it. In 1972, it was the 150th anniversary of the publication of Lettres à Monsieur Dacier, which outlined the translation of the Rosetta Stone by the French scholar Champollion. So the French got to have it in the Louvre for a month. And there were rumours at the time, particularly in the British press, that the French just would refuse to give it back. But they did, after a month. they were polite. In 2003, Egypt requested the return of the Rosetta Stone, quite rightly so, citing it as a key piece of Egyptian cultural identity. And officials pressed the British Museum, and continue to do so. And the British Museum has declined each request ever since, but did give Egypt a replica of the Rosetta Stone in 2005. Not thinking that maybe
something from the gift shop.
Yeah. You thought that maybe the British Museum could have had the replica and given the original to Egypt, but no, apparently not. But actually, it was in the British Museum for decades, not behind glass or anything. It was uncovered. People could go up and touch it.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. As you imagine, the museum eventually realised this probably wasn't a good idea, and they put it under a glass case. But it was written in 197 BCE, and it's actually, the text on it is propaganda. It's officially known as the Memphis Decree, and it's affirming the legitimacy of the king Ptolemy V, who'd taken the throne at the age of 5. His parents had been murdered, and so he'd been a boy king. He wasn't coronated until the age of 12, and there was lots of turmoil, and so he needed like a big sort of PR exercise, so it says stuff like, he has dedicated to the temple's revenues in money and corn, and has undertaken much outlay to bring Egypt into prosperity.
It's getting awfully close to make Egypt great again, isn't
yes,
it?
Yes, yeah.
A little bit that.
Yeah. So people were able to translate the Greek and then the lines of Demotic, but then it isn't the exact same text over and over again. It alternates between the three. Mm-hmm. So fully deciphering the hieroglyphics took a long time. And the problem was, for a long time, that they thought that hieroglyphics were a symbolic writing system rather than a phonetic one. So hieroglyphics does consist of logograms, which are a picture that means a word, like emojis, for mm-hmm. want of a better suggestion. Mm-hmm. But there is also phonetic meanings for a lot of hieroglyphic symbols as well. And then it was a British scholar called Thomas Young who made the breakthrough when he discovered cartouches, which are circles drawn around proper names. So they sometimes use signifiers in hieroglyphics to denote whether something is a name, whether the pictures are identifying an idea, or whether they're being said phonetically. You sometimes get an image of a mouth underneath the beginning of a word where the symbols are being used phonetically rather than logographically.
Oh, and so he used, so on the ones where it was being used phonetically, that was the way to crack the code.
Yeah, so there's the Egyptian word per, which is house, right. And it would be contained inside this square, this cartouche. But if it doesn't have that in it, then the symbol for house is just meaning the sound purr.
Oh, right. And then once he'd cracked the code, he was able to intercept the messages from the Egyptian Stargate that had a fleet heading towards London.
Yes.
And some of them had a little mouth under them, did you say?
Yeah.
And it took them how long to work out that the little mouth symbol was saying, this is how you say this?
Yes.
I mean, I am no expert, as you'll discover shortly, but I feel like that's kind of self-explanatory.
Yeah. I read a bit more about hieroglyphics and basically had a look at how to spell our names in hieroglyphics.
Brilliant.
Ben, your name is Foot Water.
Good.
A lot of hieroglyphics don't denote vowels, so that's basically a B and an N.
Okay, so essentially in Egyptian hieroglyphics, my name means may have verrucas.
Yes. Rich is mouth, quill, and then what looks like a pair of kitchen tongs pointing to the left. And I'm a foot, a bird, a mouth, and two quills.
That's very camp. A foot, a bird, and two mouth.
And worst foot forward is what looks like an unfinished nine, a mouth, a drooping stick, a sunset. That's worst. Foot is horned viper and sunset.
Why not just foot? You've got it there.
I'm coming to that. And then forward is horned viper, mouth, reversed unfinished nine, bird, mouth, and a hand reaching to the left. But a single standing leg and foot, as we've learned, is a B.
Yep.
So Barry and Ben both begin with a foot, and we host a podcast called Worst Foot Forward.
Wheels within wheels, there, guys.
Meant to be.
A foot on its own also, when it's used as a logogram, means a place. So it's a B when it's being used phonetically, and when it's logographic,
that's also going to be really complicated if you run a B&B in ancient Egypt, because people are going to be queuing up just going, I came for some chiropody.
You mean this isn't the foot business?
Yeah. I also read a bit about Esperanto as well.
Brilliant.
A constructed language. It's the most widely spoken constructed international auxiliary language. About 2 million people apparently in the world speak it. And there are, you know, maybe 1,000 or 2,000 native speakers of Esperanto at this point. People who were raised speaking Esperanto. So it was created by a Polish ophthalmologist, L.L. Zamenhof. In 1887.
I mean, he sounds like he's an incredible heavy metal guitarist or hip-hop producer.
He first described the language in a thing called the International Language under the pseudonym Doctoro Esperanto.
Until he got the shit kicked out of him by a blue hedgehog.
The book is sometimes nicknamed La Unua Libro, which is Esperanto for the first book. Mm-hmm. And Esperanto translates into English, as a Latin scholar would know, as one who hopes. Mm-hmm. Zamenhof's goal is he wanted to create a flexible language that could be used as a universal second language to foster world peace and international understanding, build a community of speakers. So it was very sort of altruistic goals. And he originally just called it the International Language, but early speakers, you know, gave it the name Esperanto. You know, in 1905, he published a book called The Foundation of Esperanto as the Definitive Guide. And then a World Esperanto Congress was established, and the Academio de Esperanto, which is like the Academie Française, which, you know, officially decides what words are in Esperanto mm-hmm. and what aren't. It's really interesting. I mean, speakers were persecuted by Nazi Germany and Stalinist Russia.
Of course they were.
You know, Zamenhof was Jewish, first of all, so the internationalist nature of Esperanto meant it was perceived as a bit bolshy. Specifically in Mein Kampf, Hitler mentions Esperanto as an example of a language that could be used by an international Jewish conspiracy. You know, they were killed during the Holocaust, Esperantist speakers. Zamenhof's family itself was singled out.
This might seem trite, but did they have like a little badge that they sewed on people who spoke
what
Esperanto?
Was the, what was the star or the triangle?
Yeah, the star or the triangle. Because because the star on the triangle was just one of several badges that they sewed on,
yeah.
Wasn't there?
Yeah, well, I don't know if they had a specific one for Esperantists, but there is an Esperanto flag. It's a green field with the upper sort of top left corner. It's not as big as the American flag. It's like the upper, if you divide it into six, mm-hmm. three and three squares, the upper left square is white with a green star in it, and that's the Esperanto flag.
Right, if I am ever captain of a ship, that is the flag that I will fly. are they pirates, privateers? No, they're linguists.
I mean, we get into very interesting territory here of what is the purpose of flags, because traditionally, I suppose, land and nation, and then here we have a nationless language which has a flag. To whom does that flag belong?
Funnily enough, you mention it as a nationless land. I may have something to say about that in a second. But before we get to that, the Esperantists didn't entirely cover themselves in glory, because they did take a move to expel some of their Jewish colleagues to try and ingratiate themselves with the Reich. They may be joined in some of the Nazis' strategy to try and protect themselves.
The thing is, I don't understand why Jews would take up Esperanto as a language. Why would you want to take up something that's going to other us even more when we already have our own weird looking language that no one else understands. It's you know, it's like the kid who's being bullied who goes, I know what'll show the bullies if I take up train spotting.
Apparently Trotsky also wrote that Stalin studied Esperanto, but during the purges Stalin reversed course and basically, again, the idea of people having a secret language didn't appeal to anyone with dictatorial tendencies. That's an understatement about Stalin, isn't it? Stalin has dictatorial tendencies.
Yes, if I
Mao had a bit of a control problem.
If I was editing that sentence, there would just be a little red mark under tendencies, question mark, see me after.
Yeah. In 1954, the UN gave Esperanto an official status as an international auxiliary language. William Auld is a writer who's been nominated for the Nobel Prize in Literature 3 times for work in Esperanto in 1999, 2004 and 2006. The internet has made the possibility of learning Esperanto even more popular. It's on Duolingo. It is the 32nd largest Wikipedia, is Esperanto Wikipedia, or in Esperanto, Wikipedia. 283,000 articles on it. But yeah, we do have this idea of it being a stateless language, but it is used in certain countries. The Chinese government uses Esperanto, and has done since 2001, for daily news on china.org.cn and on China Radio International, and for the internet magazine El Popolo Sineo. And Vatican Radio has an Esperanto version of its website, but...
So what you're saying is that the Chinese government and the Vatican are communicating to each other in Esperanto.
That's a global conspiracy I want to see. But even more impressively, the self-proclaimed artificial island micronation of Rose Island near Italy in the Adriatic used Esperanto as its official language in 1968. And another micronation, the Republic of Molossia, near Dayton, Nevada, uses Esperanto as an official language alongside English to this day. And the autonomous territory of Neutral Moresnet, which was between Belgium and Germany, existed for about 100 years from the 1820s to the 1910s. It had a lot of Esperanto speakers, and they proposed making it its official language, but it was eventually annexed by Prussia. Without any international recognition and doesn't exist anymore.
And within 5 years of their first ever symposium, you have nations saying, this will be our primary language. Like, it moves so quickly. That's why I can't get my head around within 5 years.
And before I get to my choice, I did read a little bit about endangered languages as well.
Right.
Apparently, according to UNESCO, there are more than 1,000 languages which are severely or critically endangered. However, I had a look. They have the Atlas of World Languages is a UNESCO website. In 2018, they had 64 languages which had only 1 or 2 speakers. That was 2 years ago. That number is now 44. So there's 20 fewer languages on the list in the last 2 years. There are 26 languages at the moment with only 2 speakers left. At least they can talk to each other. That's nice.
But I was going to say, if there's only 1 speaker, does that constitute a language, or is that just mutterings to oneself?
Yeah. There's Andoa, which is in Peru. There's Bare, which is in Brazil. Gadjarong, Kunjen, Kuruyaya, Oneida, which is in New York. And there's only 18 languages with only 1 speaker left. The most interesting one, or certainly one that I found on this, was Taushiro. Only 1 person in the world spoke Taushiro as of 2002, so that's 18 years ago. So your chance of being able to say anything to them is extremely low. But if you want to know a word mm-hmm. in Taushiro, you can say Unyuntero, which is hello. So maybe we could bump that number up to 3, at least. Yeah. You can add that to your list.
Unyuntero, everyone.
Unyuntero. Yeah. And we can find that one person, approach them, and say with love and compassion in our eyes, Unyuntero, and their world will quadruple in size. That is the end of a movie right there.
And another one I wrote is, in 2018, Pawnee was a Native American Indian dialect spoken in Nebraska and Oklahoma. And this dialect has 9 consonants and 8 vowels, which is interesting, because then you'd read that Pawnee, every word in Pawnee has 10 syllables, using only 17 letters.
So every word must have 10 syllables.
Apparently so. Apparently you pronounce the consonants very similar to in English, but the vowels are very French sounding with long sounds. And speakers raise or lower the tone to give different meanings.
I mean, what if you need to say help or stop? You'd be there for... Hang on, let me just get my head around this one. 10 syllables later,
yeah.
It might be too late.
But my choice for the world's worst language is going to come from the realm of cant, secret languages. I'm going to talk about Pig Latin. That's going to be my choice. But I read international versions of what Pig Latin are. In Germany, for example, you can speak Kettle Klopper Spruch, Matt English. A characteristic of Matt English, Pig Latin, for example, they substitute the first vowel with an I. And you move the initial consonant cluster and add an E at the end. The Greek equivalent is Korakistika, which is translated as the language of the blackbirds, which I quite like. The Swedish equivalent is Fikonspråket, or fig language.
Isn't the food fig language?
Yeah, fig.
That's lovely,
yeah.
I like that.
In Finnish, they say kontinkieli, which is a container language. So after each word, you add the word konti, which means container, and then switch around the first two syllables. So, for example, Wikipedia becomes Wikipedia, or that would be Wikipedia konti, but then you switch the syllables around, so you get Cockapedia winti. Or
I think that's my drag name. I told you I'd bring it back to drag queens.
And French, you have Verlan. The word Verlan is an example of how this language works, because it's you reverse the syllables. So the French for the opposite or the reverse, l'anvers, so you go Verlan.
Yeah.
So that's how you get. And for Francais is say Fran. You swap the syllables around. And it's a really cool one because it was documented as far back as the early 19th century and it was used as like a criminal code, so it's a thieves' cant, to, you know, be able to converse around even the police. But now it's used a lot in suburban areas of France, populated by migrant workers in the banlieue, and it's used as a language bridge between migrant workers from all around the world, and it's used as like a new modern slang and vernacular. It's used a lot in, you know, advertising, in French, in film scripts, in French rap and hip-hop, in French media and in dictionaries, and some words have been Verlaned and have replaced their original words in French as well.
And some words have been Verlaned and then Verlaned again.
Yeah.
It is such a cultural language, and it has been used so much to create a subculture and to genuinely speak behind people's backs.
Yeah.
Whereas other slangs try to do that. Verlan actually achieves doing that. And when people realize that muf, which is fam, which then if you switch it becomes muf, that is now part of French common speak. And so they've Verlaned it again and to make it femme, and it just keeps swapping and swapping and swapping
so that
it becomes unintelligible for the French. Yeah.
And one of maybe the most famous Verlan words might be, it's not entirely sure, it might be Voltaire. Voltaire's real name is François-Marie Arouet, but the idea is that he spent some time and his parents owned property in an area called Ervaux, which is in Aquitaine, in Western France. And so Ervaux, you reverse the syllables, you get Voltaire. So it's not entirely sure if that's the reason, if that's why he called himself Voltaire or not, but it's one of the suggested reasons. That's all far too cool.
Right.
Pig Latin, on the other hand, put the first consonant at the end of the word and add A on it. So you'd be Enbe.
Yeah.
It's referenced in Shakespeare. In Love's Labour's Lost, there's a reference to dog Latin. The modern version is in 1919, there's a Columbia Records album which has a song by a singer called Arthur Fields called Pig Latin Love, which is followed by the subtitle Ie of Le Uye Eerie Day. So I love you, dearie. And it caught on. The Three Stooges use it a lot in their movies, and it's taken to its extreme in The Gold Diggers of 1933, the movie. It's choreographed by Busby Berkeley, and you have the song We're in the Money, performed by Ginger Rogers. Most people will know the song We're in the Money.
Yeah.
There is a verse in the film version sung by Ginger Rogers entirely in Pig Latin, and it is the trippiest fucking thing you have ever seen in your entire life.
Oh, wow, she's singing backwards and in heels.
Yeah. If you were on something and watching this, it would blow your mind.
Yeah.
You're like, am I having a stroke?
Just suddenly it's Busby Berkeley in the Upside Down.
Yeah. Poles, the Louis Sacker novel. One character's nickname is X-Ray because his actual name is Rex.
Ah, that's great.
It's in Robin Hood Men in Tights. The abbot does a ceremony in Pig Latin. Zazu says Ixnay on the Upid Stay in The Lion King. I've mainly picked it because of the Ginger Rogers thing, because I watched that and it made me feel ill watching it. You're this amazing, glamorous, wonderful performer, and this is, it's not as cool as Verlan. It's very sort of old fashioned and a little too easy to see through.
And it's a little bit of a public school boy sniggery secret code that is breakable in 3 seconds.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And the A is so repetitive that it becomes uninteresting, whereas reversing the syllables of words can come up with very interesting and different words.
Yeah, it's totally intelligible very quickly. Barry, I must say, Pig Latin was also one of my choices, so I support you in this decision.
Excellent. Well, in a world of wonderful argots like the Fig language and container language, I am going to put forward Pig Latin as my choice.
As well as Pig Latin, and I also included in that backslang. I don't know if you ever spoke backslang when you were younger, but that was kind of the thing that we spoke at my school. Divagoo, yuvagoo, havagav, avagur. Do you not? Have you never heard this?
I think I have, but I've never heard it properly explained.
Yeah, it sounds like you're being remixed.
You literally put avagur in the middle. So mavagai is my name, never game, is ivagiz. And it's the same as Pig Latin. Once you understand the formula, there is no intellect required.
Yeah.
It undermines what I spent 15 years of my life doing, which is understanding the thought process behind languages and the rules behind them. And so, yes, I actually fully support your decision of Pig Latin. I first of all actually want to doff my cap to you, gentlemen, because you do this podcast, I mean, every week, the amount of ones you've done, this is what, the 100th and 180th episode or whatever, and you have to do all this research. I almost had a breakdown having to think about the 7,000 languages there are in the world and having to pick three. So many languages.
200 countries, just over 200 countries, yeah. Roughly.
And then there's something mad, like, do you guys know which country has the most languages in it? Mike, correct me on this, Rich. I'm pretty certain it's Papua New Guinea.
Oh, that might be right.
Yes, you're right.
And it's, I mean, Papua New Guinea, not that big a place, but it's something mad, like 400 languages.
Like, how do you go about picking the three worst? And also, as we've already seen today, language is so personal and so cultural. And this is why I've taken a slight, other than Pig Latin, which I think is stupid, I've taken a slightly different tact, because my degree, literally, and my studies since have all been about how important language is and how personal it is. And if I would sit here and say French is the worst language, it's a very, very complicated political.
Don't pick French, because the Academy Française would really take that personally.
Yeah, I imagine they've got a SWAT team that they deploy.
The first one I picked is a dialect, and it is a Spanish dialect called La Gomera, which is a whistle. And so it isn't a language, but it's a dialect of a language, and it's literally.
I think I know this. Is it the shepherds?
Yes.
Wow.
And it's on the Canary island of La Gomera, which I didn't even know was a Canary island terribly. I mean, I've been to Lanzarote and Gran Canaria more times I can count, but there's a Canary island called La Gomera, and this language is as old as the island itself. And essentially people whistle across valleys to transmit or to communicate important information and news. And it has two vowels, four consonants, though, and this is what UNESCO says, it is a complex reduction process to express all that can be said.
all
everything. Everything that can ever be said.
Yeah, I cannot wait for the La Gomera translation of Ulysses.
Yeah.
Like, can you imagine the audiobook?
Oh, no, I want the La Gomera translation of Finnegan's Wake.
There's an amazing documentary I watched on La Gomera, which you can see on YouTube, and the way it's spoken is they sort of stick two knuckles in their mouths as well to make the noise, because there's loads of different whistling languages. There's a place in Turkey called Kuskoy, which is known as the village of the birds. The village of Ars in France. There's languages in Mexico, South America, Kong Thong in India, where
the Kong Thong.
The Kong Thong.
That's a Cisco track, isn't it?
Yeah.
You've got Ars, you've got Kong Thong. That sounds like my kind of party.
Yeah. But I guess it's, you know, if you're going to Wales, to the valleys and distancing from your friends, you might be able to use La Gomera to whistle to each other.
Listen, I can certainly try, but the fact is, I can't really whistle, let alone with two fingers in my mouth.
Yeah.
I can do a lot of things with two fingers in my mouth, but I can't whistle. There is a bit of me, having been precluded from so many things growing up, I can't play sport, I can't really dance or even really sing, even though I make a career out of it. But imagine growing up and being like, we're now going to teach you our native language. And not being able to do it, because many people can't whistle.
Yeah.
It's quite not inclusive, you know?
Yeah. It's quite a rural island, or it was certainly when the language came about, so it was useful for shepherds to communicate to each other, or, you know, basic information about, oh no, wolf on the way or whatever.
And also huge historic events. So the massacring of the original king or leader of La Gomera, and his wife's grief. I don't know the history, but was all communicated around the island using El Siglo Gomero. Oh. So in a time before newspapers and texting and social media, this was how big events were communicated, with a little finger whistle.
And maybe smoke signals aren't really an ideal way of communicating on what might be quite a dry island in danger.
A dry farming, yeah. Very kind of agricultural island.
Yeah, yeah.
But the other thing is that it reproduces the language that's replicating. So when Spanish became the native language of La Gomera, the whistling had to change in order to replicate Spanish. So all it does is you say a sentence. So I'd say, hello, how are you? And then the whistling would go... That's not what it would sound like. But essentially, it kind of doesn't exist unless it has a host language to feed off.
Yeah. That makes sense. When I knew I was getting good at Irish was when I was thinking in Irish. You can't really reach that point with La Gomera because you've got to go, okay, what's that sound like? Rather than hearing Irish and then going, okay, what does that mean in English? And then translate. I'd hear the Irish sentence and immediately be able to respond in Irish without having to go...
Translate it.
Yeah, but with that, you have to go to Spanish or whatever the native language is in order to translate it.
I mean, that fascinates, because you know, out of the three of us, you're probably had a time when you were the most functionally multilingual, but purely because you're speaking, I would say that because you're speaking a language of your nation,
yes,
as well as English. A, do you think differently when you think in Irish? And B, have you ever dreamed in Irish?
I did dream in Irish when I was in school, but that was probably because of the impending terror of oral exams. I guess I would think in Irish if I was like properly tuned into it. And we had a very good Irish teacher in my last year in school who would insist that you would speak to him in Irish at all times, even when you weren't in his class. He was also the assistant headmaster, so you would see him for other reasons, or he would come and sit with you at the table at lunchtime and he would insist that you were speaking to Irish all the time. So you just get your, like, you think in English.
Yeah.
I guess if you're doing it often enough, you'll think in the language that you're functioning in.
People far smarter than me have written about the notion, because there's different languages that have words for concepts that don't exist in other languages. That means that people in different cultures literally think differently. They perceive the world differently.
I mean, language is entirely cultural. So I speak French fluently. When I lived in France, I have the thing of, I start to think in French, and I've dreamt in French. And there are certain things, literally goodbye, literally the word goodbye in French, as we all know, is au revoir, which means until I see you again. And that culture of, when you say goodbye in English, you're saying goodbye indeterminately. When you say goodbye in French, it's until I next see you. And small things like that, you know, the nuance of every word in every language carries with it a whole culture, a whole history, and a whole inflection which is different from other languages. And that's culture. Language is culture, language is history, and all these things are combined. And that's why I love language, not because of the semantics or the grammar, although I'm a stickler for rules, but just because of what it means on a personal level.
There's a brilliant Brian Friel play called Translations, which is about the British Army Commission, which went around Ireland translating all the Irish place names into anglicised versions. So I'm from Kildare, but in Irish that's Kildara, which is the Church of the Oak. Dublin is... The Irish for Dublin is actually Ballyochaclea, which is the town of the Grey Pool. But Dublin is a black pool. So it tells you a lot about the place.
Gotcha. I thought Kildare just meant do the murder in that particular place.
Or I dare you to kill them. Go on, double
dare. Yeah.
The neighbouring town, kill double dare.
Yeah.
Would you like my final choice though?
Yes, please.
Again, because I couldn't really, with any good faith, pick a language, which I believe is worse than others. Although I have maybe... having learned Latin, I have opinions on it. But the one that I'm going to pick is music. You mentioned music before, but I'm going to go out of the box here. Since the early 19th century, music has been described as the universal language. It's been disputed a lot as to whether it is a universal language. I'm picking it as a language in order that I can get away with not having to pick out a particular culture or nation. But also, music can be understood universally. And what do I use language to do? Whether it's English or whether I'm speaking in a foreign language, is I use it to communicate feeling, thought, and expression. And what language does that better than music? However, it is, in my opinion, the world's worst language, because Western music is kind of taking over at the moment. And I think that the idea that music is a universal language is a Western viewpoint, because we all think, oh, well, you know, if you hear a minor chord, you're going to be sad. If you hear a major chord, you're going to be happy. And that's not the case across the world at all. You know, different melodies translate for different feelings in different cultures, et cetera, et cetera. But I would say that, you know, it's a language with only 7 letters, A to G. Here we go with the westernization again. And it is a language that can be understood by anyone. But it is completely redundant because it doesn't communicate genuine meaning. There we go. But from personal experience, when I first moved to France, I lived there, and I did speak some French, but not entirely. I will always remember one of the first French friends I met running up to me is when the Black Eyed Peas, I got a feeling, was a mega hit. And she just came running up going, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday. And then after that bit, knew none of the words, but was going, and we were both having a lovely time just saying noise at each other. And that was the way that we met. You know, that was the beginning of a friendship. And it didn't, obviously, the Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday was speaking genuine words. But after that, and you know, in that song, they say, L'chaim, move it, there's so much gobbledygook anyway. Not that L'chaim is gobbledygook, you understand, but there's a lot of kind of non-sequiturs in the song. Yeah, it was the way that we communicated. And it was just through pure noise. And I think that that's, music can do that. Music can bring people together and tear people apart the same way that language can, without the use of words, which makes it utterly useless.
I think there's a lot to be said for this argument, because you get a lot of... The sound of music can be very deceptive when it's attached to lyrics. There are a few things I find more off-putting than a really sexy, raunchy, upbeat Katy Perry song being sung by some happy, poppy 5 or 6-year-olds. We're like, I love this song because it's really happy. And you're like, oh my God, listen to the lyrics.
The one that I got that on was listening to the Stone song, Gimme Shelter, which is an astonishing piece of music. But the lyrics, because it's about a pretty dark time in American history, is rape and murder, they're just a shot away. And... there's something about an entitled white kid from Surrey singing that. I mean, obviously, at the time that the Stones came to prominence, there was a big debate about can white men sing the blues, to which, brilliantly, the Bonzo Dude or Dog Band wrote a song called Can Blue Men Sing the Whites? A good piece of music can hide all sorts of lyrical crimes.
Shiny Happy People, the R.E.M. song.
Yes.
One of the happiest sounding songs you've ever heard.
Uh-huh.
The lyrics... Know what they are?
Go on.
They're meant to be a satirical translation of the Chinese government propaganda in the wake of the Tiananmen Square massacre.
Yes, I remember reading that.
Yeah.
Right.
But R.E.M. kind of hated it and never played the song live and didn't include it on their first greatest hits album, because they're like, everyone just hears like a really happy clappy pop song.
Well, yeah, the music was too on the nose. It was too good. That is, I mean, yeah, the way that music can be misconstrued, I can appreciate that. I mean, how can I put it? Spoiler alert, Rich. I consider music the greatest achievement of all human civilization. And I think that if you don't appreciate music in any form, then you frankly don't have a soul. So you're basically not going to win. But I...
Let me... music as a language, music as an art form...
Mm.
Perfect. Well, yes, I agree. One of the greatest achievements of humanity ever, ever, ever. Basically, I got to this point because I was thinking of music as a language and thinking how great it was and how it can bring people together, like the story I told about being in France. And then I thought about notation, as in the art of writing music, and how a musician can look at a piece of paper with a stave on it and clefs and be able to read what that is.
Yeah.
And I don't have that capacity, and there's part of me that's just jealous, because I would love to be able to look at a Vivaldi score and go, oh yes, I know exactly how this would sound and feel, but I can't. And then I thought, well, that's Western music. Can that be applied universally? And then I thought, well, then it's not really a language, but many people consider it is, and... It's because music is so complex and excellent at what it does that I think a lot of people put it into the category of music, of language, sorry.
You're right. And also, actually, there are some pieces of music that perhaps you could claim are universal, but actually, whether you are in a supermarket in Beijing or Santiago or Reykjavik or Johannesburg, the universal music is actually Muzak. So suddenly I'm on board with you there. And listen, you have made an extremely strong, eloquent and articulate case, and I have a lot of empathy with the rhetoric that you've put forward. But once again, not having it.
Maybe if I sing my argument.
Yeah. Regular listeners of the show, I imagine when you clicked on the link for World's Worst Language, there is something that you would be expecting from me, and I will not disappoint. Let us begin by going to the Klingon Language Institute yes. in Flowertown, Pennsylvania. Oh. And God bless them, they're self-aware. Let me read to you from the homepage of their website. Welcome to the Klingon Language Institute.
This is in English, right?
This is in English.
Okay.
No, sorry, I'm just a native speaker. Okay. I can sight read Klingon.
Translating freely as you go.
Yeah, I mean, it's very similar to Hebrew. Welcome to the Klingon Language Institute. That's right, Klingon. Those bumpy-headed aliens of Star Trek really have their own language, one which has far outgrown mere television and film. That's what we're about. We're here to promote and support this unique and exciting language. So, whether you've stumbled here by accident, or lost a bet, or have sought long and hard for people who share your passion for the warrior's tongue, come on in. Our site has information resources to interest both skeptic and enthusiastic alike. Join us in our exploration of the galaxy's fastest growing language.
Oh, wow.
So they've adorably got their tongues in cheeks, which is actually what you need to form Klingon diphthongs. brilliantly, if you lads want to learn a bit of Klingon, it is available on Duolingo.
Alongside Esperanto.
Alongside Esperanto. The real difficult thing with teaching it is because the way it was developed, and it was developed by a chap called Mark Okrand, who we've spoken about before on the show.
Whose surname sounds like a Klingon
It really
word.
Does.
Okrand.
It is the only language on Earth that has apostrophes in the middle of words.
I feel like there's an apostrophe in Hawaiian. There is. There are two symbols in Hawaiian words, the okina and the kahako. The okina is the apostrophe mark, which is like a glottal stop, and the kahako, I think, is the straight line above certain vowels and stuff.
What you say, what you don't understand is that Hawaii was actually colonised by the Klingon.
And yes, obviously Klingon came first, Barry.
Yeah, sorry, I apologise.
And that's one of the greatest crimes of American colonialism, just wiping out... Dad, where do you think Roddenberry got his ideas from? Yes, first mixed race kiss on television and all that business, but having Klingon there, just absolutely thumbing his nose to American imperialists. And the other thing, and maybe other languages on Earth have this, but they have capitalised letters in the middle of words, and depending on which letter is capitalised, that can affect the way you pronounce it and what it means. If you remember of the KLI, then you can get their quarterly journal titled The Holked, which is Klingon for Linguistics. It also publishes a fiction and poetry magazine called Jatme.
That sounds like Pig Latin.
Yeah, it does, doesn't it? And every year it hosts a five-day conference, or KEP-A, meaning great meeting, and also overpriced goalkeeper. Little joke for the Chelsea fans there. If you do go to the conference, there is an annual $500 scholarship bestowed upon a student there. You can join in on some of their translation projects. They are currently translating the likes of the Bible and the works of Shakespeare into Klingon.
How many typewriters and how many monkeys have they got working on
this? Well, whatever the Klingon version of a monkey is.
Yeah.
Is this a full-time profession for someone, then?
Someone for Duolingo must have spent their time creating the
someone
entire thing.
Someone somewhere does only this. That's what I'm saying.
I think it's mostly like a hobby that's got horrendously out of hand. There's a chap called Rich Yampel, known to Klingonists as Hod Kankor, or Captain Krankor. He definitely didn't pick that name for himself.
Don't make me Krankor.
Yeah. He's a software engineer, of course.
Of course he is.
And he is the world's first ever conversational speaker of Klingon.
It's a very one-sided conversation, though.
Yes, he is. He is the author of numerous songs, including the Klingon Anthem, Tahaj Wo. So that's a little bit about Klinger, which I felt obliged to do. Another person I want to speak about for Johanna, who funded this episode and suggested it, was Hildegard of Bingen, or Hildegard von Bingen, who is a remarkable human. She was a German Benedictine abbess who lived from 1098 to 1179. And she was a writer, a composer, a philosopher, a mystic, a visionary, a polymath, and she worked in Dictionary Corner on the medieval version of Countdown. She's the most prolific composer of sacred monophony, or monophony, so basically, I think, monastic chants.
Oh, wow.
She is also considered many to be the founder of natural history within Germany, and she's just one of these human beings who, from the moment she came into full consciousness, just work flowed out of her, whether it be calligraphic, whether it be theological, whether it be musical. And
amongst, but she a lady, so we ain't heard of her.
Well, pretty much, yeah. But she, amongst many things, constructed a language known as the lingua ignota,
unknown language.
Yeah. It is found in the Raisin Codex, and no one fully knows what it's based on or how it works. It's got bits of Greek, bits of Cyrillic, bits of Latin, bits of German. The letter Z turns up a lot.
Does it have apostrophes in the middle of the words and capital letters wherever it wants? Because I think that I might have cracked the code.
Yeah.
Is it Klingon?
Hawaii and the Holy Roman Empire. They're just planting people around the globe.
Hildegard of Bingon or Klingon?
Hildegard of Klingon. Love it. That's another one for the conspiracy theory wheel. Weirdly, the way she writes the lingua as well, it follows Roman cursive, but also there are some symbols in it that resemble signs of the zodiac.
Can people read it, or they just have the language but don't have a translation?
Sort of. There are... So I've got a picture of the lingua ignota here, and you can see it. It's got a sort of elvish feel to it, doesn't it? There are 23 letters in it rather than the usual 26 of using the Roman alphabet. And so you have words like Aengons means God, Aengans means angel, Zwains is saint, Luions is saviour, Duelis is devil. We don't really know who this was for or why she wrote it. Maybe it was an intellectual exercise. Maybe she hid some mysticism within it. And there have been various translations over the years. And my favourite historical link, in 1848, Wilhelm Grimm edited an edition of the Lingua Ignota.
One of the brothers. Wow, cool.
It's great, isn't it?
Yeah. I guess Latin was still maybe the preserve of an educated few. Maybe it was an attempt to, you know, bring religious understanding to a different, you know, teach a new language to people who didn't have Latin. That's me conjecturing now.
Absolutely. Or it might have been an attempt for her to claim a language for herself as a woman, perhaps, since Latin, I don't know how many women in the medieval church could speak Latin.
Or, you know, flip side, maybe she thought Latin was getting too widespread, she wanted it to be more elitist, and so, so no one else should have this, only me.
Yeah. Just a quick little word about Dolly Pentreath, and Dolly was the last known speaker of Cornish, and her last words were apparently "Me ne vidden cusel sorsnek," which means "I don't want to speak English."
Nice. That's the most Cornish thing ever.
Which they said just before dunking her in the river. We talked about Esperanto. There's been all sorts of different attempts to create universal languages, and particularly at the back end of the 20th century, loads of people did it. There's a German Catholic priest called Johann Schleyer, and he felt a divine presence telling him to create a universal language, and he tried to use a simplified system of roots derived from European languages, and thus came up with something called Volapük. And it...
Sorry, if you're going to call something Volapük, be prepared for people to snicker.
Fair. It spread through the middle classes rapidly, and it was again seen as a useful tool of international communication, particularly before American economic domination. Are you giggling at the phrase "useful tool"?
No, I'm giggling at the idea that in the 1870s, spreading through the middle classes were chlamydia and Volapük.
I mean, you can see it now being adopted by an Islington couple as a name for their daughter.
Vidya and Volapuk, the yes. twins.
And Schleyer, the boy.
Yeah. The reason why it didn't take off is amazing. The movement, this is quoting directly from an article, the movement's popularity faltered with Schleyer's insistence on umlauts. He said, a language without umlauts sounds monotonous, harsh and boring. And he covered it in umlauts.
I mean, if you were going to make a language, they are definitely the funnest accent that you can get.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
They're much more interesting than accent grave, and they do still be an accent aigu. And yeah. It's like, they're just fun. But to cover a language in it. And also, did you say that he was German yeah. himself?
Yes, he
it's
was.
Kind of, it's kind of being like, my language does a good thing. Let's incorporate that good thing into my new language.
Yeah.
It's a little known Saturday Night Live sketch. More umlauts.
More umlauts. I'm always a big fan of the circumflex. I just like giving E's a little hat.
Yeah. Oh, but I think the umlaut is quite fun because when you do a U, it's mm-hmm. like you're giving it little eyes and a smiley face.
Can you umlaut an O? It makes it look like a shocked face anyway.
Yeah.
It makes it like Macaulay Culkin in Home Alone. Yeah. Just a tiny little umlaut. Up until the 60s, in French, the phrase to speak Volapük essentially meant talking gobbledygook.
Oh, cool.
And Nicolas Sarkozy sort of baffled people at a UN climate summit when he said just that, you're speaking Volapük.
Huh.
There is even so famous that in the 19th century, there was a limerick published in the Milwaukee Sentinel, which was this. A charming young student of Grook once tried to acquire Volapük, but it sounded so bad that her friends called her mad and she quit it in less than a week.
With an O with an umlaut, I assume.
Of course, yeah. Yes. But for my suggestion, we are going to go to California. And I found this wonderful language called Boontling. So this is in a place called Boonville, which is the largest town in the Anderson Valley. It's incredibly isolated, rural town. So most of what they do is farming, ranching and logging. Because it is so sheltered by all these other valleys, this incredibly localized language grew up, and there's various versions about how it grew up. Some say it was jargon created by women and children and young men in the fields as a means of recreation that passed the time during the monotonous work. Other people say that it developed as a language game amongst the children there. Other people think that it might have been concocted by a couple of people called Ed Clement and Lank McGimsey. And the brilliant thing with it is it's a real mix of English, Scottish Gaelic, Irish, Spanish, Pomoan, which is a native Californian language, and various others. And so many of the words are incredibly specific in their genesis. For example, the word for fire is Jeffa, and that is because a man called Jeff Vestal, who lived locally, was very fond of starting fires wherever he went.
That's so good!
The word Charlie means to embarrass someone, and that is named after a local Native American called Charlie Ball, who was famous for embarrassing people.
That's amazing!
A doctor is a shovel tooth, named after one of the town's doctors who had wide teeth. If you're crazy, then you are Tige, named after a local drunk called Tige, who had a habit of singing the song, Hold That Tiger. You've got a Z's, which is the word for coffee, and that came from Zachariah Clifton, or ZC, who brewed a particularly strong cup of coffee.
Oh, wow.
Just one time. It was like, that was a really strong coffee. Let's name this thing after him.
Yes, immediately.
Except, of course, they're in America, so it'll be ZC.
Oh, ZZ. ZC, yeah. Of course. A payphone is called a Bucky Walter. A Bucky means nickel, and Walter was the first chap in the valley to have a phone.
This is great.
It's wonderful, isn't it?
We have a joke when we play board games. About halfway through every board game we play, Ben will suddenly go, oh my God, I'm such an idiot. Because he'll suddenly realise the error of his strategy up to that point. And so among our family and yours, we say, oh, you've bend it right up.
Yeah. I mean, that is specifically one game.
Yeah, so when someone makes a mistake in a board game, to ben it up.
Yeah.
Obviously, rich is a thing, but, you know, if you were riching, or what is a rich?
Can you decide for yourself? Because these all seem to be things that the community have endowed upon the object.
Yeah, so, that's true.
I mean, maybe I would be something with ever-changing hair colour, because I dye my hair a lot. So,
yeah.
when someone's hair goes light in the sun, you could say, oh, you're riching in the sun.
Yeah. I like that. That's great. What would be McStay?
I know that's a Barry already. Barrier is because I was a notorious cock blocker when I was in university.
Barry the Barrier. Yeah. I mean, it works on so many levels.
Yeah.
That is linguistically satisfying as opposed to just arbitrary.
Yeah.
Let me tell you a little bit more about it. There's here's a little conversation between a couple of chaps called Wes Smoot and David Knight, who are speakers of it. You've been boshing, just a slib. You get a granny hatchet. Nope, mostly just Gorman and horseshoes. Which translates as, have you been deer hunting? Yeah, but only a little. Bagged one yet? Nope, I've been eating barbecue and playing horseshoes.
Oh, so horseshoes is actually...
Sorry, horseshoes is horseshoes. Sorry to let you down there.
I was the thing I was most excited about to hear what horseshoes was translated to.
And now there's only about 100 speakers left of this language, which has a vocabulary of almost 1,600 words. It came to national prominence in 1971 when a local called Chipmunk appeared on Johnny Carson's Tonight Show. And Johnny asked him about going to Boonville to burlap a bald dame. He was asking him about shagging a good-looking lady, because to burlap is to do a bit of lovemaking.
Ooh. As in a burlap sack?
Yeah. I imagine so. What does that
say about their sex life?
That it chafes.
It's very itchy and coarse.
Yeah, what is a burlap sack?
Like Hessian.
Very brown, it's very Hessian.
Yeah. Right, got you. Boondling for me, it's not even, maybe not a heroic failure, but because you essentially cannot understand it unless you have grown up and been steeped in the culture of this one place in the middle of nowhere in California. And whilst it's a delight to hear and a delight to go into the etymology, it is essentially functional hillbilly nonsense.
It also sounds a little bit akin to, and I did say that I'd bring this back to drag queens, it sounds a little bit akin to the New York 80s slang, which has now become common parlance in the gay community. Stuff like Yas Queen and mopping to steal, sashaying, chanteing, and this kind of undercover language, which is used so that outsiders couldn't understand the inner community, which has now become quite common parlance in not just the gay community, because it began in the black trans communities of New York, and it's now become spoken by every Becky and Katie across America and the UK.
Yeah, well, we talked recently, I think, a bit about Polari as well, and how it's often enclosed groups or repressed groups who have to come up with a new way of circumventing the authorities. And it's interesting that we now live in a place where a language of one of those groups has now become so worldwide and all-encompassing, thanks to RuPaul's Drag Race, let's be honest.
I would love to know if you can again stack languages on languages and have a gay French immigrant who moved to Boonville and spoke a mixture of Polari, Boontling and L'Envers.
Verlan, yeah.
Yeah, so Verlan, so did like inverted Boontling versions of Yas Queen.
With a whistle thrown in every
now
and
then. Yeah. Our suggestions this week are Barry's sniggering schoolboy tricks of Pig Latin, Rich's mildly controversial choice of all music in the history of human civilization, and mine of the esoteric hillbilly cant of Boontling. Once again, a wildly eclectic pick and mix. Rich, I've made my opinions clear on your choice, and whilst I understand the robust logic behind it, I cannot look myself in the mirror if I pick music as the world's worst anything.
You brought the wrong weapon to this particular
me and Barry have talked about this before. The way this show works, you very much have to try and play the man. It's like a game of poker.
Listen, I'm nothing if not controversial, and I wanted to do a little mic drop there. So.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, and it was either that or pick English, wasn't it? Let's be honest.
Yeah.
So,
yeah,
why do you hate English so much?
The fact that it's everywhere, and that we assume that we should be able to be understood when we speak English, and also because it is so clumsy with its rules, and we mess it up all the time. When you have a language like German, which is so rooted in rules, or you have a language like French, which plays with its rules in a poetic way, English is just fucking clumsy. Every time I see a sign saying, this door is alarmed, I think, no, it's not. This door is fitted with an alarm. I just want to know what's wrong with the door and what's given it such a shock.
You are right. I mean, the thing that I love about English that I imagine is awful to a non-English speaker is that it is such a magpie language. And, you know, that is mostly, but not entirely, down to colonialism. Like, yeah. Obviously, when I go on holiday, as someone who's not great at languages, I'll attempt some of the local language, you know, to order drinks and food or whatever, but then we'll give them a pleading look of, please God, I have reached the boundaries of this. Yeah. Speak English to me now. And I'll be like, thank God for the convenience, but also, colonialism.
So I chose a language which is transcends culture, which is music. But it clearly didn't go down well.
No, mate, it was a beautiful, warm, thoughtful decision, which, as I said, no time for it. I chose Boontling knowing that it wouldn't win, because whilst it is rare and almost impossible to learn if you're not from there, I think we're all charmed by it.
Yeah, we all like it.
It's really delightful. And Pig Latin... it's because it, like you say, it's very one note,
yeah,
as a constructed language. And I think there'll be all sorts of people who have suffered at the hands of Latin when they went to school. The porcine version is even worse. And you can just imagine Jacob Rees-Mogg and Boris Johnson tittering away to each other on the front benches, passing notes to each other in Pig Latin. Yeah. So
they'd call it Wild Boar Latin, though, of course.
Monstrous.
I defy anyone to watch the minute long of Ginger Rogers singing We're in the Money and not feel immediate hatred for it.
I just simply can't wait to get very drunk tonight and watch it. Yeah. In my little lockdown isolation moment, just have a real psychedelic experience with Ginger Rogers.
Every word will make complete sense to you.
Yeah. Yeah, it'll feel like the doors of perception are slowly melting away. Before we go, we would like to tell you some of the best news of the week, which we will continue doing until the world is in a considerably less unstable place. And we go to the Yaraka Hotel in remote southwest Queensland, who have had to bar a couple of members for bad behaviour. These are a pair of emus who were hatched and raised in the town and become a tourist highlight. However, recently they've learned to climb the front steps of the hotel and are causing havoc.
Is Rod Hall,
yeah,
a frequent guest in this hotel?
Yeah, back from the dead.
Yeah.
The manager of the hotel said, we didn't really want them becoming patrons because when they get in here, they behave very badly. Emus have been known to target tourists, stealing their food, drinks, car keys, and generally making a mess. Brilliantly, the way they've kept them out is by erecting rope barriers at the entrance.
You're not coming in here with those claws.
Yeah. And to be fair to the hotelier, who clearly knows his history, the emus still hang around each gate, hoping that they will be able to slip in when someone opens it up. But so far, we're winning the war, knowing that they don't want to kick off a second emu war.
Which we've talked about on the show. Yeah. Oh my God, that's so good. But I mean, emus as patrons notoriously disruptive. We had to bar a couple of them from our Patreon.
Yeah. So, Rich, before we go, where can people find you and what can they find you doing when they get there?
Currently in a flat in East London, but in general, I'm on Instagram at RichWatkinsLDN. My show, Happily Ever Pufter, is on Instagram also at Happily Ever Pufter. We've got a website, happilyeverpufter.com. Pufter spelled P-O-O-F-T-E-R, not with a U and not with a P-H and not with an A and all the other derivations of Pufter. Should the world continue on the course of hopefully rehabilitation and recovery that we're on right now, you'll be able to catch the show at a South London night spot, hopefully very soon, at a socially distanced, very responsible performance. Otherwise, I can be found teaching young school children at South London primary schools all about the intricacies of language and hopefully instilling a joy of music in them.
Glorious stuff. Well, we are all off to rich our hair whilst hoping there's no burying going on as I Vanderveld across the city at the same time. Until next time, bye-bye.
Bye. Bye.
First Foot Forward is part of Podnose, the UK's leading independent entertainment podcasting network. For episode archives of Worst Foot Forward and all of the shows on the network, visit us at www.podnose.com. You can also follow us on Twitter via @podnose or send us an email via admin@podnose.com.